The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
And good morning and welcome to this March 14th, 2018 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm going to give you more information on how to access that later in the hour. I'm your host, Marie Stone. We are doing what we do each and every Wednesday morning, which is chat with authors about their books, about their process, about their craft. I always enjoy connecting the dots between my two authors of the morning. At least in my own head, I enjoy collecting the dots, but I am having kind of a harder time doing that today, which actually has made this morning very fun for me. I am here now with my favorite psychotherapist, crime fiction, modern-day Pittsburgh author, Dennis Palumbo. His character is so stuck in my head, I'm calling him Daniel now. And in the second half, I'm talking with young adult fiction author Vera Hiranandani. She will join me for the second half. Dennis, as I say, my favorite creative psychotherapist, is a former screenwriter who wrote My Favorite Year, Welcome Back, Cotter, other stuff. He is now a licensed psychotherapist in private practice, the author of the mystery collection From Crime to Crime. And his short fiction has appeared all over the place, Ellerly Queen's Mystery Magazine, The Strand, elsewhere. He's the author of the Daniel Rinaldi mystery series. Head Wounds is the fifth in that series. It's published by Poison Pen Press, and we are going to chat about it this morning. Dennis, not Daniel, welcome back.
Oh, it's always good to be here. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. So I consulted my notes. This is our fourth time together on the air, but it's been 4 years since you've been on.
Yes, it's been 4 years between the last Rinaldi novel, Phantom Limb, and the current one, Head Wounds. That's a long time, I know, but Head Wounds is a very special book.
Yes, it is. Well, Daniel has been through a lot since we last spoke. I hope time has been easier on you than it's been on Daniel in the last 4 years.
Oh, it's got to have been. Yeah. Daniel Rinaldi goes through a lot in this book. As some of your listeners may know, he is a psychologist who was born and raised in Pittsburgh and, like me, also went to Pitt. And he is a consultant for the Pittsburgh Police. He specializes in dealing with the victims of violent crime. He's a trauma expert. And in Head Wounds, the fifth in the series, readers finally get to learn what actually happened to his wife. In the first book in the series, Mirror Image, all that is said is that years earlier, he and his wife had come out of a restaurant, were mugged. The mugging went sideways. Gunshots came out. The wife was killed, and Daniel, though injured, survived. And so he struggled with survivor guilt for many years, and then his mission began, which was to treat the other victims of violent crime and the traumas that they had had. In Head Wounds, we finally find out the truth about what seemed at first to be a mugging. And what is also different in Head Wounds, in my previous four books, there are thrillers, but there are also whodunits, where at the end you find out who the killer is, and hopefully it's a big surprise. In Head Wounds, I lay out who the villain is fairly early in the book and do instead a kind of cat-and-mouse game between Daniel and the antagonist, Sebastian Maddox, who is a brilliant computer genius and delusional. And that's a tough combo. And so what I wanted to do is write the most harrowing experience of Daniel Rinaldi's life. And so I really pushed the envelope on suspense in this book. And I think if the reviews are anything to go by, most people found it pretty darn harrowing.
Yeah.
But I also like the fact that finally we get some closure on what happened to Daniel's wife and some relief for poor Daniel at the end of the book.
When did you know what happened to Daniel's wife?
When I started writing this book.
So you
didn't
know
when I started the series. I thought she had just died in a random mugging.
Okay.
I'd had so many people, readers, over the years say to me, was it just a mugging? Are you sure? And I thought, well, maybe I could make it something more interesting. And then once I had read a little bit about erotomania, which is the delusional condition that my villain, Sebastian Maddox, suffers from, the story clicked for me, and I knew how to tell that story. So it wasn't until Head Wounds that I actually understood that Daniel's wife had been murdered deliberately, that it was supposed to look like a mugging, but it actually wasn't.
So was this story led by Sebastian? Tell me about what kind of guided you into it. Was it wanting to explore what happened to Daniel's wife, or was it Sebastian's character, or kind of what was the thread that...
It was kind of both, because in this book, we learn about Barbara's life prior to her marriage to Daniel. I mean, she becomes, frankly, a much more vivid character in this book, as opposed to a sort of, I don't know, I hate to say it, kind of a convenient trope in the mystery series world, you know, a dead ex-wife so that your hero can have girlfriends, which is essentially what her death was for. But instead, she becomes a very important character in the book, and we actually meet her through her notes, her diaries, and also that Sebastian Maddox had a delusional obsession with her. And so his obsession causes him, because he believes that by marrying, by Rinaldi marrying Barbara, that was the wife's name, he took her away from him.
Right.
Rinaldi took Barbara away from Sebastian. And so even though Barbara did not respond to any of these protestations of love and affection, and we're going to be here together as soulmates forever, he was convinced, like people with erotomania are, that Barbara was the love of his life, and that even her denials were just a way to test the depth of his feeling for her. So when Rinaldi marries her, he considers this a tremendous betrayal. And so Head Wounds is about his systematic attempt to take from Daniel everything in Daniel's life that he loves,
right,
whether they're patients or colleagues or friends or family members. And it's quite harrowing and frightening because he seems always one step ahead of our hero.
Mm-hmm.
I've had a number of readers say, gee, I didn't even know if Daniel was going to get out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can't ask for more.
So one other thing that I was going to note is that you, there was a little bit of lag time between the books, and I was wondering if that 4 years, well, certainly the world has intervened, but I was wondering if this was a tougher novel for you, you know, from a writer's perspective. It seemed different textures we've talked about from the other four, and I was wondering if that, if there was more revision processes going on, if it was just tougher to access, if the characters gave you more trouble.
Well, it was a combination of all those things. First of all, you know, I have a full-time therapy practice, so while some of my mystery writing colleagues turn out a book every year, usually for me it's like 2.5 years between books. Yeah. This one took a little bit longer because I did a lot of revisions. The characters were difficult, and I put my hero's friends and relatives and colleagues in really difficult situations with a lot of jeopardy, and I had to figure them all out. Also, because my villain, Sebastian Maddox, is a computer genius, and I'm a moron when it comes to technical stuff, I had to keep Googling and talking to my son and other people to try to figure out whether half of what I was talking about was possible, and it turns out it's more than possible.
Yeah.
So I think the combination of the intensity of my private practice and trying to figure out all of the twists and turns in the book made it come out longer. I did do a number of revisions.
I do want to talk about technology because that was such a fun aspect of this. I, too, am kind of a Luddite, so, you know, but I live in a very high-tech family. Everybody around me is really high-tech, so I thoroughly enjoyed the technological aspects while not fully understanding them. But that would be fun as an author, especially as a crime author, and tricky to keep up on what is possible, what technology can and can't do, and to remain. I mean, your characters always seem a little bit smarter than the they seem a little bit smarter, so you have to be a little bit smarter, and you have to be on top of stuff that they're already experts in. So talk a little bit about how you do that.
Well, it's kind of difficult because as you and I both are Luddites, I also am very suspicious of technology. On the whole, I think it's been a disaster for humanity. And so one of the things I wanted to do with Sebastian Maddox is make him make use of the tools of technology, particularly the way they intrude on privacy, on the way in which you feel you can never escape from the eye of technology, whether it's through your cell phone or your laptop or you know, anything. And plus, we live in a world where things get hacked so much. So, you know, our hero will suddenly find on his laptop an image from a traffic camera, a live streaming image from a traffic camera where our bad guy's about to run over somebody. Well, because our bad guy hacked into it and is now sending that signal to Daniel Rinaldi. And I have checked, and everything that happens in the book is possible now. Mm. And in fact, as I have one of the characters in the book mention, that both the head of the CIA and the head of the FBI have duct tape over the cameras in their personal laptops because they know those cameras can be hacked and, you know, computers can be turned on at a distance. So everything in the book is real. And since I have a little bit of a prejudice against how technology is affecting us as people, I found it helped make Sebastian Maddox not only a bad guy, but make him seem kind of unstoppable,
yeah,
and that he was always one step ahead of my hero. And that really, really worked for me. I think that's one of the things that makes the book work.
Talk about being one step ahead of your hero, and your hero being, your hero's a very smart guy, and everybody in the book recognizes he's a smart guy, surrounded by other people who are also smart, and being pursued by a guy who's even smarter than all of that. So is that a challenge for you to stay five steps ahead of the person who's already four steps ahead?
Oh, absolutely. The thing that's so difficult in writing a book like this is you want to make the villain seem as though he's so far ahead of where the hero is, the hero can never succeed. And the thing that I'm proud of is that at the end of the novel, the reason that Daniel Rinaldi is able to succeed is because he plays into the psychology of the villain. He doesn't, like, outwit him technologically. He'll never in a million years be able to do that. But he is an expert on the human mind and the human psyche. And his ability to turn my villain's very particular psychology against him at the end of the book is one of the things I'm most proud of.
Yeah. And you said this went through a lot of revision. Let's talk about that. What does that look like? What did the book look like in draft one, and how many drafts were there? And
there were like three drafts. Okay. And first of all, it wasn't as relentless in the earlier drafts. There's always a lot of fat. I love describing people in Pittsburgh, and especially because the books are in first person, I'm in Daniel Rinaldi's head all the time. Well, I love giving readers a sense of what it's like to be inside the head of a therapist, like in a session. In almost every one of the novels, we see Daniel Rinaldi in session as a psychologist with a patient. And I have a tendency to overwrite all that stuff. But since I know I'm going to trim it, I mean, I have a rule in my head, which is it's not going to leave my desk unless I think it's pretty good. And so I allow myself in the first draft to just overwrite his reflections, his memories, his theories about clinical work. And I also overwrite a lot of descriptions of Pittsburgh. It's a city I love. And more importantly, as I've mentioned to you in other interviews, it's a city that's gone through an incredible transformation from a kind of blue-collar industrial hub to this kind of very gentrified, white-collar, high-tech world. Mm-hmm. And those two worlds live side by side. I mean, if you go downtown, you'll see some brand-new medical building or technological building, like where they do state-of-the-art nanotechnology or robotics, and they'll build this nice steel and glass building. And then one block over, there will be the old cobblestone streets from 100 years ago with the streetcar tracks still in them. That tale of two cities.
Right, right.
Makes Pittsburgh a wonderful conflicted character itself. But when it comes to writing about it, I mean, I want to make sure it doesn't turn into a travel guide. So my first drafts are always a lot about the city. And it's funny, too. I must mention, I have a lot of, you know, as you would imagine, readers in Pittsburgh. And whenever they email me or call me, they never talk about the characters or the plot. They always just say, you have Daniel make a left turn on South Street. You can't do that. You know, right. And my favorite story is I had a reader in Pittsburgh, I still have her, I think, who's a city planner. And my hero, Daniel, his office is in Oakland, and his house is up on top of Mount Washington. And she said, well, I've read the first three books in the series. I really like them. However, the way you have Dr. Rinaldi go home from his office in Oakmont makes no sense. I'm a city planner, and she sent me a diagram of how Daniel should actually go home during traffic. And she was right. So in the fourth book, I changed how he goes home from his office, and I gave her an acknowledgement in the front of the book for being able to finally give Daniel Rinaldi the best way to go home.
That's a sign that you have a close reader. That's very nice.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm glad you brought up Pittsburgh, because as I was reading this one, and as I was last night, as many of us were riveted to the Pennsylvania congressional run, I was thinking that Pittsburgh is sort of the one of the canaries in the coal mine for what's going on in this country. And I thought, you know, in subsequent Rinaldi books, it will be interesting to see you return to Pittsburgh and what happens to this town.
Well, it's undergone, as you know, since the last election. I mean, where Pittsburgh and in some cases Philadelphia have changed with the times, the middle part of Pennsylvania, which is, you know, coal mining and steel, those industries are gone. And despite what the current administration says, they're going to stay gone. And it's very, very tough for those workers. In fact, Billy Joel's song, Allentown, is about Allentown, Pennsylvania, and how the economy took such a hit when everything changed in terms of using coal and being a resource-driven economy. In fact, you know, when I was at Pitt, I worked my way through college at J&L Steel Mills, and those mills are all gone now. And so when you see steel being erected in these new buildings in Pittsburgh, the steel is all imported from Japan, which is just incomprehensible for people who've lived in Pittsburgh their whole lives.
Right. Hence our current quagmire, but that's a different radio show, so I'll you did a great essay on, I don't know how long ago it was, but on what crime fiction does and how it gives the reader a sense of sort of the social and cultural and political realities. I think, you know, fiction does that in general, but you were talking about how well crime fiction does that. And I'd love for you to just talk about that for a minute, the things that crime fiction can do in addition to keeping us, you know, awake at night and not turning off our bedroom lamp when we're supposed to.
Well, the article was about how crime fiction is a great reflection on society. I mean, if you want to know what Los Angeles was like in the 30s, you look no further than reading Raymond Chandler.
Yeah.
Or if you want to know what London was like in the 1890s, look no further than reading Conan Doyle's Sherlock Holmes stories.
Yeah.
Because, as Thomas Wolfe said, the one of the goals of writing a novel is to display the status details of a culture. And crime fiction does a really good job of doing that for two reasons. Number one, there's a lot of specificity in a crime novel. I mean, if you read a Sherlock Holmes story and Holmes and Watson go to a pub and have what they call a cold supper, you know exactly what it is, and Conan Doyle tells you how much it cost. And so when he talks about the class system in London, when some duke or earl is consulting Sherlock Holmes and he takes out the Burke's Peerage and reads all the initials behind this guy's name and why he's the Duke of whatever he is, you get a real sense of the class structure in London. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's one reason I think crime fiction is a very good mirror to our society, though it's a dark mirror, as I call it, because it tends to be very detail-oriented, not to mention the forensics and how police work. But on the other hand, I also think it's a reflection because crime drama is driven by big passions, love, hate, envy, jealousy, sex, greed. And there's no better reflection of a culture than how the human condition is expressed through it. And crime, because it's so exaggerated, because, you know, in real life you can hate your brother-in-law. In crime fiction, you get to run them over with a truck. Right. And so we realize, oh, there's a lot of tensions in families. But, boy, there's a real lot, a whole lot of tension in a family in a crime story because someone's going to get killed. And so it very much illuminates, I think, aspects of our culture like income inequality, segregation, racial issues. I mean, if you read Walter Mosley, it's the best description of being a black person in America, much better than what some sociologist is going to say, because Mosley is emotionally invested in that.
Yeah, right, right.
And I think, for example, Gone Girl is one of the best depictions of the modern state of marriage that I've ever read. It's like if Philip Roth had written a psychological thriller.
Right, right. So good. My guest this morning is Dennis Palumbo. We are talking about the latest Daniel Rinaldi, Head Wounds, number 5 in the series. I'd love to pick your brain about, I think sex scenes are really hard. There weren't a ton of sex, I could always use more sex scenes, there weren't a ton in here, but the ones you have are great. And I love that they're a bit female driven. And I was wondering from the psychotherapist, writing from the perspective of the psychotherapist about sex scenes, I think those are tricky for writers. I think people get a little bit squirmy. They try to either gloss over them or they become so detail-oriented that it's hard for the reader to read. I was wondering if you have any insights to help writers out.
Well, I feel about sex scenes the way I do about scenes of any kind that have conflict or violence or proactive action. They've got to be emotional. I don't like sex scenes that are so specific you feel like you're reading a manual where it's mostly about hydraulics. And that doesn't interest me. What I find, I try to be specific only in the sense that I want us to have a sense of arousal or eroticism. Too many books go, well, they spent the night together, you know, because they're so timid as writers, they're afraid to discuss what happened.
Right.
I'm willing to write what happened, but I do it hopefully in a lyric enough way that you feel the emotion of that connection or the lack thereof. To me, a sex scene only has value if it illuminates character. To put a sex scene in a thriller just because, well, I guess you're supposed to have a sex scene, those always stick out like a sore thumb to me.
Yeah. Right.
Whereas I tried in all my novels, and particularly Night Terrors and this new one, Head Wounds, that have specific sexual scenes in them, to be as detailed as possible in terms of explicating the level of eroticism and arousal, but also to understand what's going on between these two people and how they feel about each other.
So your recommendation is to approach it more psychologically than physically.
Yeah, I think that's more important, but I think that's true of violent scenes. I think it's true of domestic argument scenes. It's always, to me, you know, I always think of what Henry James said, which is plot is characters under stress. Mm-hmm. And if you're writing scenes in novels and you don't feel there's conflict in the scene, you don't feel anyone is being stressed, you don't feel there are any stakes, then you got to look at that scene again.
Yep.
There has to be stakes. Emotional stakes, if nothing else, in every scene, or else there's no reason for the reader to turn the page.
Right. How much time did you spend in Sebastian's head? Like, how well did you feel you had to understand him, given that the book is told from a first-person perspective from Daniel? How much of Sebastian did you know that never made it onto the page, but that you just had to understand about him?
Well, there was a lot. I mean, I thought about him a lot, and luckily he's so verbose and so in love with the sound of his own voice.
Right.
I got the fun of having him speak a lot. He certainly was not a taciturn, you'll never guess what I'm going to do next villain. He tells you what he's doing next. In fact, he shows it to you on the screen. And so his grandiosity, his sort of narcissistic self-absorption and grandiosity made him very fun to write. I just imagined myself as someone who not only had all this villainous intent, but thought he was entertaining as hell. One of the things that one of the characters in the book even says is he thinks this makes him winning. He'll quote some philosopher, because he was a philosophy major, he'll quote some philosopher, and then the next thing he mentions is some pop song. And she says this combination of pop culture and deep dish thinking, he thinks this makes him charming. And it doesn't, but he thinks it does. He just thinks he's adorable.
Right.
And even when he does something small, like, you know, there's a scene where Daniel just opens up his laptop, and instead of his regular screensaver, there's an 8x10, like, actor photo of Sebastian Maddox. And his voice on the computer says, look, I thought your screensaver was stupid, and I take a nice picture.
Right.
And so it's funny in one way, but very creepy.
Yes.
And what I was always going for is how creepy it is that someone has access to you all the time. I mean, I'm one of those people that if I buy something online and then 2 days later a bunch of pop-ups start showing up for similar types of products, that freaks me out.
Yeah.
You know, I'm suddenly part of an algorithm that I didn't sign on to.
Right.
Well, that's what I wanted the reader to feel. I want them to feel like, Jesus, I better check all my security protocols on my computer.
Right. Which I did. Yeah. Yep. Well, it worked.
I did.
We covered a lot. Is there something we should have covered that we didn't? Any advice that you...
Well, I always, you know, my advice to writers is always the same, because I've had writer's block. I've procrastinated. I've been worried about rejection. I've been depressed that I'm not as good as I think I am. All those things, and all my patients have struggled with issues like that. And my advice is really simple. Just work the problem. Mm-hmm. Don't make yourself the problem.
Yes.
Writing is hard, and if you're blocked, it just means you're trying to do something that might be more personal or difficult than anything you've done before. The block is not the problem. The meaning you give the block is a problem. If you start saying, well, I'm blocked because I'm not a good writer, or I'm blocked because the story doesn't really work, and maybe this means I should have listened to my parents and gone to law school, you're making yourself the problem. Writing's hard. Work the problem. The other thing I'd like to say is, just in the name of shameless self-promotion, is if your listeners want information about me, they should go to my website, dennispalumbo.com.
Which has a ton of great stuff on it, all of your essays, and I think you can find all the great advice that you've been giving for so many years. You know, I'm glad you brought that writer's block advice back up, because I have a little card that sits on my desk from you. That says that exact advice, which is to work the problem, and the problem isn't the writer's block. It's the you.
Yeah, and don't make yourself the problem. Writing is hard.
Yes.
You know, it's not stocking shelves in a supermarket.
Right.
Which I have also done, by the way. it's hard. And the reason I know that it's good to work the problem and struggle to navigate the block is I've never known a writer who, having navigated a writing block, didn't feel they were a better writer on the other side of it, that they had grown somehow. So it's like a developmental step in the life of a writer.
Such good advice. So good. Dennis, it's always great to have you on.
Oh, thank you. You're so kind to have me.
I love it. We'll have you back on for number 6.
Oh, as soon as the writer elves show up at my house and start writing it, we'll be in business.
Hurry. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
That was Dennis Palumbo. The book Head Wounds is out and available now. Super fun read. We're going to take a very short break. Please stay with me. Vera Hiranandani is going to be with me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other shows up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are on iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can also visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. Next Tuesday night, March, I think it's 20th, we have another speaker series event. If you are interested in that, it's all nonfiction. Karen Carbo will be there. You can check out the website for that. I'm your co-host, Marie Stone, onward with the show. Vera Hiranandani earned her MFA in creative writing at Sarah Lawrence College. A former book editor, Vera now teaches creative writing at Sarah Lawrence Writing Institute and Writopia Lab. She is the author of The Whole Story of Half a Girl, which was named a Sydney Taylor Notable Book and a South Asian Book Award finalist. And most recently, the author of The Night Diary, published by Dial Press, a division of Penguin Random House for young readers. We will chat about that and more this morning. Vera, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's an honor to be on the show.
Thanks for coming on. We don't do young adult fiction enough, and every time I do it, I say we have to do more young adult fiction because it's such, A, it's a hot market. B, it's
yes.
Wonderful. I mean, the world of young adult fiction from today versus when I was a young adult has just taken off. So I love the opportunity to talk about this. So it's great.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well,
so,
me too.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. So congratulations on the book. I'm going to let you kind of take us into The Night Diary and
sure.
The inspiration for it and a little bit about Nisha's life.
Absolutely. So the book is about 12-year-old Nisha, who has to leave her home during the partition of India in 1947, and she writes a diary to her deceased mother, who she never knew, basically explaining her journey through this time over about 4 to 5 months. And this book was inspired by my father's own journey when he was 9, when he also had to leave his home during partition, and make his journey with his family, his parents, and his 5 siblings over the new border to India. So he makes the same journey from Mir Prakas, Pakistan, to Jodhpur, India, that Nisha makes in the book.
Amazing. Were you motivated by the project sort of as a way to tell your father's story or as kind of a teaching tool to modern day students or as kind of a way to discover mm-hmm. and learn something yourself about your dad? All of the
sure.
above? Probably all of the above, huh?
Yeah, right. All of the above, I think. But I think first, this was a story that I had always heard. It was something I kind of carried with me as part of my own experience growing older and understanding the world. So it was something that my father didn't talk about when I was very young. And then when he did start talking about it, I didn't always realize the magnitude of the history. I only realized that as I got older and asked more questions. And I just became more intrigued and more confused, really, by the history the more I learned about it. I remember when I was 11, and I had always heard family stories, but I never heard anybody else talk about this piece of history outside of my home. And then we all went to see the movie Gandhi. And I remember seeing partition depicted in this very dramatic, incredibly violent way, which it was. It was such a violent piece of our global history, but it was just so shocking to me that was the same partition I had always been hearing about from my father. And I couldn't believe that, you know, he went through that period of time and that I was connected somehow. And that really stuck with me. I didn't know I would grow up to be a writer, so it wasn't necessarily, I didn't know then that I would write about this someday, But I really remember that point where I never stopped thinking about it, never stopped asking questions about it. And so it is something that I've carried with me. And then, of course, I did become a writer. And it was something I wanted to write about for a long time, but I didn't feel ready for a long time. I've probably been writing, quote, seriously since my 20s, and I didn't publish my first book until I was 40. And then it took me years to sort of to feel like I could attempt it and even try to do the subject matter justice.
Yeah.
So it took me a while to get to that place.
It's interesting because I have a friend who writes about the Armenian genocide, and we mm-hmm. talk a lot about generational trauma. And I do think there's something to that, that whatever your parents or grandparents went through somehow, I don't know if it's through DNA or through how they were raised, and it just gets filtered through how they raise their kids. But I do think there is something to this generational trauma that gets passed through. So I don't think it's a coincidence that you would have been, well, obviously it wasn't coincidence, but that you wouldn't have been, you know, so connected to the story in a more personal way, even though you didn't live through it or you didn't live in India.
I think there's
something to that. It's interesting.
I think so. And I'm by no means an expert, but I feel like I have read studies about that you do sort of on a almost molecular level, carry a traumatic event from your parents possibly. So I definitely think that there's something to that. And for me, it was really just, really, I just felt this desperation to understand it. But, you know, even after all the research and after writing about it, there are still, I have many questions, which I think most people do, looking at the history and what happened.
Well, it's also interesting because I think so your dad is from India and your mom is American, yeah?
Yeah. So my mom, right. So my mom was born in Brooklyn, and my dad was born in India, what is now Pakistan. And of course, they met in Poughkeepsie.
Of course.
So they come from very different backgrounds. My mother's Jewish. My father's Hindu.
Yeah.
So that was certainly another layer to my personal development, but that's always in my writing as well. I'm always exploring people with multiple identities, sense of belonging, sense of home. That was something I was always grappling with growing up. I grew up in a small town in Connecticut, and I went to a very small private school that my parents' friends actually started.
Oh, wow.
It was a very unique experience. There were about 50 kids in the entire school, and really my elementary school experience was being in this class with 8 kids, and we were basically a family, and it was a very arts-based school. And then I had to, the upper grades there, they didn't have enough kids to form a fifth grade class, so I was sent to the public school, and that was a really huge change for me. Being kind of thrown into this large public school where nobody knew me in a small town in Connecticut. And suddenly that was the first time I realized that my background was different. Like I had no idea it was really until that time in fifth grade where people, couldn't pronounce my name, made fun of my name, asked me questions about both my Jewish and Hindu backgrounds. And, I really found myself not being able to answer a lot of the questions, was sort of stunned that they were even being asked. And so that really became, that kernel became the inspiration for my first book, The Whole Story of Half a Girl. And then...
That's interesting.
And then
that's sort of the age, right, that Nisha is. I'm trying to remember what fifth grade is, but it is about kind of 11, 12, right?
11.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, that's interesting that you, your writer's head goes to that place where you're grappling through all these issues of identity and belonging and, you know, having a foot in two camps. I talk to a lot of writers, I feel like, who feel like they have a foot in two camps, or they're expatriates mm-hmm. or they're outsiders, and they're trying to find their way back in. And it seems like the mode of doing that is often through writing.
Absolutely. And I wonder, you know, most writers that I am friends with or talk to or hear their stories, I agree. I see that similarity that usually it is the outsider who becomes the observer. I think when you don't feel a part of something, you really are forced in some way to sit back and observe, which is excellent training for right. being a writer. So I think I was also a shy kid. So it's, you know, it's really a mix of things of why I was sort of the outsider, observing what was going on around me. So I don't know. I'd be curious to hear the perspective of a writer that was somebody who always felt a part of things, maybe was really popular and, right. didn't grapple with their identity so much. I don't find that. But I'm sure everything exists. So I would love to hear that perspective because I think it would be really unique.
Or boring, right?
Right.
That's funny. So tell me about the diary structure and how that came about, what it gave the novel, and maybe what was mm-hmm. difficult about working with the diary structure.
Sure. Well, I think I wanted a really intimate point of view, even more intimate than first person. So the diary felt like a natural place. And it's where I always, in my early drafts, it was always the diary. I never started with anything else. As I finished my draft and talked to people and eventually talking to my editor, my agent, we opened up the question, would it be too confining? Is it too confining to just tell this story through diary entries? And I did experiment a little bit by having a different point of view alongside the diary entries. I think I did third person, possibly. Mm. But something wasn't, it was just breaking the flow of what had already been created. And I think that even though I take a leap in that sense, you know, there are times where I am in a diary entry describing that Nisha is describing things in a fuller way, in more of a scene structure with dialogue, that maybe a 12-year-old kid in her situation or in any situation wouldn't fill out so completely. I felt like I'm just making that leap, and the reader will either go with it or not. I sort of set it up in the beginning that she wants to kind of tell the story of what's happening in her life, like stories she's read, so she's sort of imitating that idea and writing her own life story. She has no idea that her life story will be so dramatic. And she's also, you know, I felt like she's very shy. She really has trouble speaking to people outside of her family. That's a real obstacle for her. And so I felt like this was a place for the first time that she would get to know herself and communicate in a way that she never had before, because it was the first time she was writing in a diary. And so we were going to hear the Nisha that she hadn't even heard, mm-hmm. you know, other than in her own thoughts. And she certainly didn't express herself even to the closest people in her life in the way that she was going to express herself. And then, of course, she's writing to her mother, which wasn't always the case. I originally had her just simply writing in a diary. And then I felt like something wasn't complete. Her motivation wasn't feeling completely organic to me. And her mother, I still had set it up that her mother had died. And then suddenly it dawned on me, of course, she's writing to her mother. So I made that change pretty much after I think I wrote a full draft, possibly without that, or maybe in the middle. It's hard to remember. You know, the first draft is so many years ago from when you're holding your published book. So
Right. Yeah, it did. I thought the diary structure worked so well because the intimate lives of 12-year-old girls, as you learn through the Diary of Anne Frank, or actually being a 12-year-old girl, is so much more rich and surprising, I think, than you could get from just watching a 12-year-old girl move about the world. You know, it's you really get access to, you know, they're far more sophisticated than I think we often give them credit for. And they're going through so much. I mean, that's such a charged time of life, separate and apart from whatever's going on in politics for Anne Frank and for Nisha. You know, I mean, it's that setting, using that diary structure, I think is just really compelling. And the mother, who, as you say, is deceased, really comes alive. We almost get to know her just through Nisha's projections onto who she wishes she was, or the little bits of information she knows about her. So she really becomes an effective character on the page when, you know, even in her absence. I thought that was really cool. Is it hard to keep that age? Yeah, so you're writing from a different age you are, B, a different time, you know, a different time you never lived through, and a different place you never experienced.
Right.
I don't know if one of those three gave you the biggest hurdle of trying to overcome that, or to kind of talk about writing from the perspective of such the other.
It's certainly a challenge. I think the biggest challenge for me was the setting, because that was where I felt like I had to take the greatest care and do the most amount of work and research to get it right. I think becoming a 12-year-old girl is incredibly easy for me for some reason. I feel like in my head, at least, not always on, you know, translating onto the page, but in my head, I feel like maybe because that was a very pivotal time in my own development, my memories are very clear about those few years, sort of 11, 12, and 13, in my own sort of coming of age and the world kind of revealing itself to me is a much more complicated place than I thought it was, and this loss of innocence that I think so many girls and kids experience during that time. And that's why I think so in young adult literature, it's split into two categories usually, and so it's middle grade and young adult, and then some people just call the entire category young adult, but in a lot of novels that are called middle grade within publishing, usually the character is 12. It probably it's the most common age for that younger young adult novel. And so I think that that's a big reason why, because I think so many people have such a universal experience. But getting back to why this was difficult, what was the most difficult part, was, honoring the setting, you know, holding the responsibility for being accurate. I felt really intimidated by that early on. I wasn't the best history student. I'm not a historian by any means. And I really wondered if I could do this. And I talked to my parents about that. And certainly I talked to my father a lot. And he has he has an engineering background. He holds facts and figures really well. He was able to talk out a lot of the history, correct me when I was wrong. And then, of course, I read a million books, mostly nonfiction, talking about the history, so I had the foundation. But that was ultimately not what I was going to be talking about in this book. I mean, I certainly, it's surrounding them, what's happening politically to their country, and so I through a 12-year-old, what a 12-year-old would know about that, what she sees in the newspaper, what she hears her father talking about, what she sees from just what's around her, that was going to be the perspective. So she wouldn't necessarily have a clear idea about what's going on. But my mother actually sent me this quote after I was explaining to her, you know, my doubts of whether I could do this. And it's an E.L. Doctorow quote, and I'll probably mess it up a little bit, but basically it says, the job of the historian is to tell what happened, and the job of the novelist is to tell what it felt like. And that quote really helped me understand what I was trying to do. So as long as I had the basic historical foundation, then it was really, really getting to know this character and really trying to understand what this might have felt like.
Yeah, yeah. So much great food in here. I was hungry. Gosh, I went out and had Indian food. But I mean, food is such a big part of the culture. And as you're, as they're making this journey, there's a very painful sort of dehydration. You know, they're going without water and they're going without food. And, you know, it's so very visceral. And the things that you're right, as the politics are kind of swirling around you, it comes down to, where am I going to get my next sip of water so I don't die? I mean, that's really what's on your mind. And so accessing those human emotions and getting it down to kind of the micro level really does make the story come alive, you know, for the reader. I know it just came out last week, so it's probably too early to ask this question, but I'm curious, the experience of having the book out in the world versus the book, you know, on your computer and getting readers' reactions. And I don't know if you've had even a chance to go talk to kids in schools and book clubs and whatnot, but to get, I always think it's interesting for a writer to have the book come back at them in ways that maybe they didn't expect, or people see things that you didn't see. But the book as its own thing outside of your hands, I think, is always kind of interesting.
Yes. I know. It's a really mind-blowing experience because it takes so long to write a book, and it's really this very tight relationship between you and the manuscript and then you and maybe a few readers on the way and then your editor. And then to suddenly have people, you know, saying things on Twitter and going to schools and talking about it. I did go on a book tour last week, and I was able to visit schools a few a day. Basically, I made a few stops across the country. And so that was really exciting because it was the first time I was really talking to young readers about the book. They hadn't read it yet. It was more because they had just gotten the book. So most of them, I was kind of giving them the intro and read a little so I would give them a sample. But I felt a real curiosity about what I was talking about. I felt a really positive reception. The kids, I think, you know, they seem to respond to the diary format because I think that's something, you know, with a younger person, there are different kinds of kids, different kinds of learners. So some kids might be really intrigued that this is historical. Other kids might think, oh, that's going to be something hard and dense and maybe something I won't understand. I certainly felt like that a lot of the time with some of the historical texts I was given to read. So I think there was just this openness and excitement about kind of the idea of reading somebody's diary, that anybody could kind of relate to and connect to. So I felt really, so far it's been so positive. I'm trying to think of any reactions that surprised me. I mean, most people don't know about the history.
Right, yeah.
And so that's okay, because I don't know if I would if I hadn't grown up with the personal family connection. I don't remember learning about it in school.
This is really how kids should, we're drawing down our time, but this is really how kids should learn about history, I think. I mean, it's so much more accessible when it's told through fiction than if you just read some dates and places that have no connection to you at all, you know.
I agree.
Yeah, it's a shame that history isn't just taught this way. So tell listeners where they can find you. You have a website.
Yes, so I have a website, www.verahiranandani.com, and I have a Twitter feed, as they say, so they can contact me on Twitter at Vera Hira. And cool. Then I'm on Instagram at Vera Writes.
Oh, great.
So there's
no way we can't find you. I love it. I love it.
Right. Yeah. Well, these days,
you just have
to be kind of out there everywhere, in person, on social media. So I'm kind of learning as I'm going.
I love it. Vera, thank you so much for taking the time. Congratulations. It's a great, great book.
Oh, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Me too. That was Vera Hirandandani. The book is The Night Diary. It is out and available now, and it is a great, great read. If you have kids of this age who would love, I mean, it's so relevant to today's times. We didn't even get to talk about that, but it is so relevant to what our country is going through now. history repeating itself. So I highly encourage you to pick it up. That's all the time we have for today. I'll be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great, great day. And stay tuned for more great programming on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.